From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a Muslim perspective of Islamic-rooted terrorism.
Muslims should be loyal to the places where they live, whichever country they are. These are the voices that need to be strengthened instead of giving the platform to these hate mongers.
The UN is to mediate Libyan peace talks. An Egyptian court acquits defendants in a debauchery trial. And history is made as a Palestinian team debuts at football's Asian Cup. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. More than 40 world leaders and 1.6 million people joined for a massive rally of solidarity Sunday in Paris, following France's deadliest terrorist attacks in decades. Similar rallies were held in other parts of France, as well as cities around the world, bringing marchers to the streets of Berlin, Brussels, Istanbul, and Madrid. Lisa Bryant was on the scene in Paris.
The Place de la République in central Paris was a sea of people, so jam-packed that it took about a half an hour to move a few inches. Banners were brandished everywhere in support of love, free speech, democracy, and multiculturalism. Many simply read, "I am Charlie," in support of the dozen victims of Wednesday's attack on Charlie Hebdo magazine. Islamist militants have been blamed for the shooting and for two other attacks last week that killed a police officer and four Jewish men at a kosher market.
Ils n'ont pas vengé le prophète, ils l'ont insulté, ils l'ont déshonoré.
Mamoun Abdelali, an imam from the Paris area, was among many Muslims at the rally denouncing militant Islam. The assailants, he said, didn't avenge the Prophet Muhammad. They insulted and dishonored him. Another Muslim, 17-year-old Amina Tajouri, brandished a Jewish newspaper that read, "I am Jewish, I am Charlie."
We are not okay with that fact. We disagree. We totally disagree. Jews and Muslims refuse to be enemies, and we refuse to let people be killed for that. Everyone is allowed to talk. Everyone is allowed to say what he wants to say. And vive la France.
Dozens of heads of state, including Palestinian, Israeli, and African leaders, as well as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, briefly joined French President François Hollande on the march. Earlier in the day, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and European Interior Ministers held talks on terrorism in the capital. Security was unprecedented at the rally, with several thousand police and military deployed. The Paris terrorist attacks are the worst in recent French history. They have left many here, like teacher Edith Godin, in shock.
I'm like fed up with all the hatred in the world. I can't stand people hating each other anymore. More than just liberty or freedom of expression, it's more like I want people to live together, and I want people to just try to accept each other, even if they are different.
But not everyone here offered messages of reconciliation. Franklin Boulot, sporting a red baseball cap, said he was afraid of Islam.
Ben moi je suis complètement peur de musulmans parce qu'en fait ils veulent complètement nous détruire notre société parce qu'on.
Boulot said Muslims wanted to destroy French society and they were trying to kill the French people. French authorities are braced for other attacks. Hundreds of French have joined jihads in the Middle East. That may have been the case of at least one of the assailants. Police are still hunting a top suspect, the 26-year-old partner of one of the killers. Reports say she may have left the country before the shootings, en route to Syria. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
What is the Muslim perspective of Islamic-rooted terrorism? For an answer, we spoke with Muslim American Fahim Yunus, national president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Men Association of the U.S.
As a Muslim, Prophet Muhammad's honor is extremely dear to me, but I would protect his honor by giving life instead of taking life. Just like the Muslim French police officer who was the first victim of these terrorists, Susan, who died defending the right of this magazine to mock the Prophet. Even though it's extremely hurtful and distasteful to us, we as the Ahmadiyya Muslim community believe that there is not a single verse in Holy Quran that puts any gives any punishment for free speech, that blasphemy laws are un-Islamic, and we stand against that.
Is a violent response to the satirical journalism a clash of cultures, I say, of freedom of expression in the West versus respect for Islam among these extremists?
Not at all. Islam has a 1,400-year-long history, and there is a history of tolerance for centuries. This is a new virus within the body of Islam, Susan, where the clergy, the clerics, the leaders within the Muslim communities, they have created, concocted this virus of blasphemy laws that they're trying to link it to the core teachings of Islam. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself was blasphemed during his own life, but he pardoned each and every such person. Islam and Quran only teaches us to walk away from such situations. So this is not a clash of civilizations. This is actually a brain tumor. This is a misunderstanding of these Muslim clergy who are now then projecting this hatred to the young, disillusioned men in the Western societies.
The irony of this is that these terrorist attacks with Islamic roots, they're actually hurting the Muslim community in general.
They are the most hurtful, and you're absolutely right. More than 90% of the terror victims are unfortunately my Muslim brothers and sisters, my family members. So therefore, it is incumbent upon us, and that is what the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is calling upon all these Muslim communities for the past one century, that we need to unite under a reformist movement. We need to unite for pluralism, and we need to stand for various larger definitions of Islam. There is a reductionist thinking in Islam today where everything is being reduced. And we need to, the Muslims have to come up with a solution here to expand the definition that Quran gives of a Muslim, of what Islam is, what free speech rights are, and what the Prophet said, not what these clergies are trying to project on us.
You mentioned the Muslim community taking steps, but is there anything people outside the Muslim community can do to help get rid of these young, usually men, terrorists that are causing so much horror?
Absolutely, and I think what you are doing, I think we need to continue to strengthen the moderate voices. We need to continue to strengthen those who stand up for reform. To give you an example, USA Today just a few days ago ran this horrible op-ed by Anjum Chaudhary. This guy is to Islam was appendix as to a human body, Susan. This guy does not stand for anything. Nothing he says is supported by Holy Quran, and yet he is given the platform in one of the largest newspapers in the United States as compared to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. We do have a voice, and we do try to do our best, but here is a community that for over 100 years is standing up for jihad of the pen. The founder of this community has said over 100 years ago, under British rule, that he believes in separation of church and state, and Muslims should be loyal to the places where they live, whichever country they are. These are the voices that need to be strengthened instead of giving the platform to these hate mongers.
Fahim Yunus, national president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Men Association of the U.S. and a senior fellow at the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. In the wake of the twin terrorist attacks in Paris, the White House announced it will host a summit on countering violent extremism, focusing on domestic and international efforts to curb extremist violence before it occurs. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, who met with European security officials in Paris Sunday, said there is an increasing need for countries to share information to counter such threats.
The White House says the February 18th summit will highlight domestic and international efforts to prevent violent extremists and their supporters from radicalizing, recruiting, or inspiring individuals or groups to commit acts of violence. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said these efforts have become more imperative in the light of recent attacks in Ottawa, Sydney, and now Paris. The summit presentations, panel discussions, and small group interactions will showcase programs in Boston, Los Angeles, and Minneapolis-St. Paul to integrate the efforts of educators, mental health professionals, religious leaders, law enforcement, the private sector, and technology community in heading off violent extremism. Summit presentations will also draw on the experience of other countries in trying to prevent attacks and foreign fighter recruitment. Holder said Sunday on the ABC program This Week he made an appeal to European interior ministers to take part in the summit.
So that we can come up with a way in which we can deal with the root causes of what it is that attracts these young men to these really negative ideological groups.
The Attorney General says information sharing among nations is crucial in the fight against extremism.
One of the things that we have certainly gleaned from these interactions is there's a greater need for us to share information, to knock down these information sharing barriers so that we can always stay on top of these threats. One nation cannot by itself hope to forestall the possibility of terrorism, even within its own borders.
Jonathan Shanzer, a former terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Treasury Department and now vice president of research at the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, says many of these efforts were started in the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. He says the Paris events appear to have focused the Obama administration anew on the threat posed by terrorism.
The problem is that we may have lost a lot of valuable time. And I think probably another important thing to note here as well is just the way that the topic is framed is somewhat problematic. In other words, calling it violent extremism without talking about the ideology that spawns this violence, I think does us no favors. And ultimately, I think will put us in a position where we will not be in a position to win.
Shanzer says the U.S. already has important bilateral and multilateral intelligence-sharing relationships. He also says religious leaders, particularly Muslim, have been involved for years in efforts to diminish the terrorist threat.
Teachers, I think that could be a very interesting one. I think there's probably not been a lot of work with the various public school systems or even parochial schools. The question, though, is whether teachers are going to be able to be honest about what the challenge is without having to potentially insult students or their parents. Working with the tech community, this is obviously incredibly important. The tech community can provide a huge amount of clues, and we know that, for example, Twitter and Facebook and other social media outlets have been providing assistance to the intelligence community for many years now. But they have been fighting with one hand tied behind their back because, again, they are not allowed to profile. There is extreme sensitivity about what it is that we're looking for in the first place.
Shanzer says Europe has already been hit with high-profile terrorist attacks, noting the 2004 Madrid train attack and the 2007 London subway bombings. He's not sure the French attacks last week will fundamentally change Europe's approach to terrorism. Attorney General Holder says there is no credible information that al-Qaeda was behind last week's attacks in Paris. He says al-Qaeda's leadership has been decimated by more than a decade of reprisals.
The threat now really, I think, comes from al-Qaeda affiliates, and chief among them would be al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula.
Holder says they have the ability to inspire people, they have explosives experts, and a capacity unmatched by any other terrorist organization. As the French consider new security measures, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will arrive in France later this week for talks on countering extremist violence. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Football's Asian Cup has kicked off in Australia. For the first time, a team representing Palestinians is taking part in one of the world's biggest sporting events. The Palestinian team says the tournament is as much about politics as it is about sport. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Bravo, 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 bravo. This is the first time that a Palestinian team has qualified for the Asian Cup. And the sweat and concentration on the faces of the players training in Sydney show they mean business as they prepare for their toughest ever assignment. The Palestinian population of about 10 million people is divided between historic Palestine and a large diaspora, mainly in neighbouring Arab countries. The players too are spread far and wide. Amro Hanoun, the team's media manager, says preparing for the Asian Cup has been a challenge.
We have players from West Bank, we have players from Gaza, we have players from overseas, they play in Europe. We have the Palestinian who lives in Israel. It's hard to make a training camp in Palestine for them all. So we're trying to make a camps in Jordan, United Arab Emirates and Qatar to preparing for this historical championship for us.
Defender Tamar Salah says the team's ambition is to make the Palestinian people proud.
For him, it's historical.
to be here in Asia Cup in Australia. Not just for him, it's for all Palestinians to be in Australia. It was like a dream. For us, it's like it's a World Cup, not just the Asian Cup. They will try to do best to make our people in Palestine very happy.
The team's appearance comes as Palestinian officials are trying to make headway in gaining recognition as an independent state, most recently by filing paperwork to join the International Criminal Court. The United States and Israel have opposed those efforts, arguing Palestinians haven't yet established a state, and efforts to do so are counterproductive to the peace process. In Australia, these are exciting times for the local Palestinian community. Many have turned out to watch their team's training sessions. Fan Walid says the excitement began when the Palestinian team qualified for the Asian Cup finals by winning the 2014 AFC Challenge Cup in the Maldives last May.
I remember that night very well. It was about 2 a.m. I was watching on the internet, and when Palestine just scored, I just couldn't handle myself. I was screaming, jumping on my bed in my room. That was a really hysterical day.
Another supporter, Hanan, had brought her young children to watch the team train.
Well, I think it's very important that my kids know that our background is Palestinian, and it's wonderful that the Palestinian team has been able to come all this way out. We'd like to support them.
Dan Goldberg is a documentary maker who's been charting the Palestinians' adventure since they qualified for one of the world's biggest sporting tournaments. He says the tournament is as much about politics as it is sport for the Palestinian team.
I think the players themselves, and certainly Jabril Rajoub, their president, openly and unashamedly admit that they are here as much as a political statement as they are as a sporting team. It's hugely important for them as a putative nation who hasn't yet been officially recognised to be seen on the world stage. But the very mere fact that they are here and will be seen globally is for them a victory.
Awaiting the Palestinians in Group D at the Asian Cup being held in Australia are not only defending champions Japan, but former winners Iraq and Middle East rivals Jordan. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
UN-mediated Libyan peace talks aimed at reaching a political solution to end the fighting in the conflict-ridden country are expected to get underway this week at UN headquarters in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports mediators are urging the warring factions to seize this opportunity to restore stability.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!
Armed militias celebrate the capture of Libya's Tripoli International Airport in August. It highlights the ferocity of the fighting among rival factions, which has engulfed the country since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi's government in 2011. The unity among the warring factions, which succeeded in ousting the country's long-serving dictator, quickly evaporated after his death. Now, two opposing governments and two parliaments, each backed by rival, heavily armed militias, are competing for power. UN spokeswoman Yvette Morris tells VOA the United Nations is hoping to break this deadly logjam.
The UN's special envoy, the Secretary General's envoy for Libya, who is also the head of the United Nations support mission in Libya, Bernardino Leon, hopes that the talks could help to lead to the formation of a unity government that enjoys wide support and pave the way for a stable environment in which a new permanent constitution can be adopted. He's also hoping that the talks will put in place security arrangements that will help to bring an end to the armed hostilities raging in different parts of Libya.
But no date has been set for the talks to begin, although they are expected to get underway later in the week. A round of talks scheduled for December 9th was repeatedly postponed because of intensified fighting between the internationally recognized government and Islamist militias. But the UN support mission in Libya, which is hosting these talks, believes this time the warring factions will stick to their word and meet. UN envoy Leon is calling for the parties to freeze their military operations during talks. He says this will help efforts to restore stability and prevent a further slide toward deeper conflict and economic collapse. He warns the parties not to let this opportunity slip by, as it may be their last best chance for achieving peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An Egyptian court has acquitted 26 men accused of debauchery after they were arrested last month at a Cairo bathhouse. Homosexuality is not officially illegal in Egypt, but men are often prosecuted under the more vague charge of debauchery. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The decision Monday by a Cairo misdemeanor court to acquit 26 men accused of debauchery was met with applause inside the courtroom as onlookers cheered and the defendants chanted. Much of the Egyptian press has been referring to the case as the trial of the gay bathhouse orgy participants. The defendants were arrested in early December after police raided a Turkish bath facility in the center of Cairo. TV cameras showed the men being paraded out of the facility with only towels to cover themselves. Prosecutors accused the bathhouse owner of using the facility to aid and abet debauchery and the defendants with debauchery and violating public decency. Homosexuality is not officially a crime in Egypt. The case gained notoriety after a well-known Egyptian journalist profiled the alleged indecent activities at the Turkish bath in the center of Cairo. Several Western journalists tweeted pictures of the female journalists taking photos of the men as they were being arrested by police. Several Western media organizations had likened the case to the notorious prosecution in 2001 of 52 men arrested at a floating disco on the Nile known as the Queen Boat. Human rights activists have repeatedly pointed to the case in recent years as an example of injustice by the Egyptian judiciary. American University of Beirut political science teacher Hilal Kashan tells VOA that sex in general remains taboo in the Arab world, and homosexuality is even more of a taboo, although it is frequently tolerated behind closed doors. Homosexuals in the region, he says, are still in the closet. Kashan notes the Islamic State group in Iraq has reportedly been throwing those convicted of homosexuality from the tallest building in the city. Kashan says Egypt, under King Farouk, who was deposed by the military in 1952, was regarded as the citadel of Arab liberalism, mostly due to the cosmopolitan nature of its two largest cities, Cairo and Alexandria. But Kashan stresses that given the pressure Egypt is now under from the outside world for alleged human rights abuses, it is easier to make a concession on homosexuality than on political protests or the Muslim Brotherhood. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
In Cairo Sunday, more than 170 international and regional health experts gathered to discuss how to prevent Ebola from spreading to the Middle East. Evaluation missions to 18 countries discovered the region is ill-prepared for a similar outbreak as has occurred in West Africa. In Sierra Leone, British health worker and volunteer Alan Curtis was asked if he is concerned about contracting the deadly virus, as did British nurse Pauline Cafferkey, who remains in critical condition at a London hospital.
The training's excellent. I've got a lot of experience. I'll have to be jolly unlucky. But having said that, of course, as soon as I go in the red zone, I could do something. Someone could do something to me. Of course there's a fear. Of course. I'd be foolish to say otherwise, really.
Curtis, like Cafferkey, is working at a clinic in Kerrytown with the charity Save the Children. It is investigating how the British nurse contracted the disease, concedes it may never find out. Rob McKelvery is the Save the Children regional director.
We don't want anyone infected by Ebola. And it did cause great concern to everybody involved. But we need to turn that concern into a professional approach to be able to look at what happened. Are we able to determine the source of the infection? And if so, what we need to do to make it right in the future.
Nearly 21,000 people have been infected with Ebola, mostly in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com for the latest news. I'm Susan Yaki, reporting from Washington.